This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
We are delighted to have Robert Pollin, who's a professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And right now, among other things, he's been working on a book with Noam Chomsky that discusses the challenges ahead and what needs to be done. And the specific challenge is climate change, one of the most serious crises facing the world today. At stake is the future of civilization as we know it, yet both public awareness and government action lag way behind what's needed to avert a climate change catastrophe. And we're going to tackle the issue from both the perspective of climate change and the issue of what has this got to do about workers? And as we reach unemployment levels that are near what the Great Depression wrought, talk about the issue of rebuilding an economy that is not business as usual and its impact on the workers and its impact on, as you say, the greatest crisis of the world today, climate crisis.
Well, that's quite a bit to talk about. Let's just first say, of course, I'm not a climate scientist, so I'm going by mainstream climate science. These are sober, probably mostly fairly conservative researchers. And they are saying, it's time to panic. This is truly, we are facing an existential crisis with climate change. Of course, nobody knows exactly for sure what's going to happen, but there is a serious possibility that we're facing absolutely disastrous consequences, and significant parts of the entire Earth's surface are going to become unlivable. That's not definite, but it's possible enough that we absolutely have to take action. So the type of action, you know, the Green New Deal that I advocate and have been advocating, and that, you know, my very eminent co-author Noam Chomsky equally advocates, is really a program to transition the entire global economy off of fossil fuels first and foremost, because that's the main source of CO2 emissions that are causing climate change. And then we have to focus also on reforestation and stop destroying our forests that, among other things, absorb carbon dioxide, and our agricultural system, wherein organic agriculture absorbs carbon dioxide, but industrial agriculture does not. So those are the main components. And doing that is the other big story in our book, and many other people recognize, is that this is a major, an opportunity to transform our societies as well, and to generate jobs, make sure they're good jobs, make sure they're open to non-whites, minorities, make sure that unions have a big opportunity to grow within this clean energy transformation project. Create opportunities for new forms of ownership, cooperative ownership, as we effectively expropriate to fossil fuel companies, public and private, all over the world. So that's really that's the basic thing.
Now, Bob, everybody's, of course, now concerned about the coronavirus, and rightfully so. And to some extent, this has eclipsed the Green New Deal. But it doesn't eradicate the Green New Deal. So in terms of the Green New Deal, it comes from the New Deal, which dealt to a large extent with jobs. How do you propose to replace the jobs that are lost when you fix climate change by new jobs in the Green New Deal?
Well, of course, right now, the COVID crisis is paramount. And as we talked about right before the show, I myself just gotten over being infected with it, and as my whole family was. So I know personally it's quite real. And the U.S. is doing disastrously on this. We have to keep that in mind. There is this virus out there, but the way that it impacts people and economies depends on the policy interventions, the leadership of the country. So if we look at other countries, take Australia, okay, just as one example, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but they're at deaths per million or something like 10 deaths per million, and ours are like 550 deaths per million. Or take probably the most interesting case, Vietnam has had a total of, the last time I checked, 22 deaths total, 22, not 22,000, not 220,000, 22 deaths. For a ratio, if we applied the Vietnam ratio to the United States, fewer than 100 people would have died. So we definitely have to completely change and make a serious commitment around public health. I don't know that that can happen under Trump. But in any case, the coronavirus will get controlled in some way within the next year or 2 years. There will be some reasonably effective vaccine. But we still will have suffered through this depression that we're in now. And the Green New Deal, in my view, is a program that enables us to grow out of the depression in a way that is sustainable, that is using the spending to build a green economy as also a basis for job creation and opportunity. So there will be jobs lost in the fossil fuel economy, but the fossil fuel economy jobs that are lost is 1/100th of the jobs that are going to get created by building the clean energy economy.
I don't mean to be intrusive, but I can't help but ask that in terms of you and your entire family getting COVID, and I understand from a pre-telephone conversation that we had or pre-interview conversation that your daughter had it particularly bad. Your thoughts, are you angry? You are a person who does have scientific knowledge. You're a researcher, a studier. You're not an epidemiologist. But your thoughts, as we talk about environment, and certainly the spread of disease and contagion is part of our environment, and they very well stem from the kind of conditions, wet markets and the like, and the food patterns that people are driven to in this world. So really, the issue of your thoughts about having gotten the coronavirus, COVID-19, and where this fits in to the whole question of revamping our social structure so that it can accommodate the human condition and allow it to be sustainable, among other things.
Well, that's a great question, and certainly on the personal level, of course, I don't know. I just thought I would never get it because I was being so careful, and I was just with my family. But then I did go outside our little family unit to visit my mother, who was in Washington, D.C., and sure enough, I got it. And then I brought it back to the whole family. So, yeah, I mean, anger because the assumption is, well, this is the way we're experiencing this virus. But in other countries, you know, Vietnam, the per capita income is 3% what it is here. They don't have a health budget. They have a health budget that's probably 3% of our health budget. But meanwhile, they're protecting their population. So the fact that we have utterly failed to protect the population, I happen to be one of the minor victims, but the fact that we failed to protect our population is a massive indictment on the nature of neoliberal capitalism. I didn't know this beforehand, but I mean, it was well known, apparently, I've since found out, among epidemiologists that a severe pandemic was very likely to happen given the patterns that were already existing. And climate change is a big part of the reason, because what's happened with climate change is that the humans have encroached on animal habitats, which have brought the animals and humans in much closer contact, and therefore have made us much more vulnerable to the type of viruses that animals, bats, rats experience, but, you know, they're not problematic for them. They become problematic when they get transmitted to the humans. Yeah, I hadn't really given any of that any thought until, you know, the coronavirus came up. It's also the case that how people get affected by the coronavirus is significantly impacted by the degree of air pollution and the degree to which we have unhealthy air to breathe. So a solution to the climate crisis, which eliminates CO2 emissions, also is going to be the main thing that enables us to start breathing clean air. And I myself have been working on this issue for over a decade. Really, what do we think about the job prospects? And the fact is that spending money on building the clean energy economy, on renewable energy, raising energy efficiency standards, building electric vehicles, increasing public transportation, insulating buildings, and so forth, it creates jobs across the board. Yeah, one of the fallacies is, oh, well, yes, there's jobs, but they're jobs, yeah, for research scientists figuring out how to build it, put up cheaper solar panels, for example. And yes, there will be jobs, but there's a lot more jobs for people on the roof, the roofers installing the panels, and for the truck drivers delivering the panels, and for the secretaries who are filling out the forms, and for the accountants who are figuring out where our money goes. So there's really jobs like anything else. Most of the jobs are just going to be general jobs, equivalent to the types of jobs that are predominant in the economy today. I mean, the one big difference, if we boil it down, you know, comparing with fossil fuels, of course, there's not going to be jobs for people, for coal miners. There's not going to be jobs for people on oil rigs. And instead, there will be people that are going to insulate buildings or drive buses or put solar panels on roofs. And it is true, and this is part of, you know, kind of the backlash, the jobs after, you know, decades of struggle, the jobs in the fossil fuel economy are better jobs. They make more money. They have better benefits. That's a fact. So it's, you know, I've been in conversations with people, union representatives and workers who work in fossil fuels. They say, oh, this is all well and good. You're giving me your job numbers, but those aren't good jobs, and we're not going to get those jobs anyway. So we have to really focus on transitioning people and making sure they're made whole, making sure their pensions are there for them, and making sure they get move into good positions in the future as this transition takes place.
Bob Pollan, when we talk about the Green New Deal, that's been largely associated with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, and our newest electee who overcame the challenge from the Kennedy family for the first time in their history in Massachusetts, and that's Ed Markey. So is this the Green New Deal that you're talking about? And if you could be a little bit more specific about what the Green New Deal actually combines in terms of an economic approach with the ideas of renewable energy and resource efficiency. What does it really look like? What are you talking about?
Well, what I'm talking about is a little different than what they're talking about, because what they're talking about is very, very general. And I think probably I'm on record as having written, I think it was too general. So I've been arguing I love the spirit of what they've done, and I did do some advising for Bernie Sanders around the issue. But for me, it really means, it has a specific meaning of the project to transition to a net zero economy over the next 30 years, and all the things that we need to do to accomplish that goal, and to do it in a way that's good for working people and good for communities. And so that's the way in which we evoke the term the Green New Deal from Roosevelt, but it needs to be also focused more than the 1930s New Deal on environmental issues. The 1930s New Deal did have a significant component called the Civilian Conservation Corps that was creating jobs for people to do environmental and reclamation and other forms of environmental cleanup. But this is much bigger challenge. This is transforming the entire energy system of this country and the world And well, and then we've accomplished that, we have to make sure that we're protecting our forests, and we have to also transition our agricultural system so that we can maintain a system that is healthy and sustainable and that absorbs CO2, carbon dioxide.
One part of the Green New Deal legislation that was proposed, I mean, it wasn't legislation yet, it was a proposal, was taken directly from Roosevelt in his 1944 speech of a federal jobs guarantee for workers.
Yeah.
In addition to Green New Deal jobs, what do you think about that proposal for a federal guarantee for jobs?
Yeah, I think we should have a full employment guarantee, which, as you said, was passed. I mean, the Full Employment Act of 1944 is law. But the one thing I'm concerned about with various discussions around the full employment proposals or the job guarantees is that we have to also be concerned about the job quality and not just that there be jobs, because, you know, you can have makeshift jobs for people that have built up skills and, you know, good compensation levels. So what I would want to focus on not only is on the green parts of the stimulus, but obviously, we need to improve our public health care system, and that creates jobs. We need to do things beyond just the Green New Deal, I mean, green energy. We need to transition agriculture. We need to restore land. We need to give people access to broadband. As we see, there's massive disparities in access to broadband, and this is terrible now for kids whose families do not have access to broadband. Effectively, they can't even get any kind of education while the kids, everybody has to stay home. And starting there and, you know, thinking about also building up public transportation, rail transportation, bus transportation, all of these things are part of a broader transformative project that the Green New Deal should be the core of. But there's other things as well. And as we do that, we have to make sure that we are creating enough jobs so that we can get to full employment and stay there. So the Green New Deal project is so big that it's going to take us at least a generation to get it done properly. And so that should be a major source of jobs along with these other things.
Of course, the thing that is so concerning is that we have a liberal grouping of people who are certainly not yet on board, it would seem, with the dire predictions that Mr. Noam Chomsky has related in the number of discussions and articles that I've seen of his and that we've talked to you about. So my concern is in terms of, now granted, you don't have to do everything. There are people who do the research, there are people who formulate the ideas, etc. But nevertheless, look at the nature of our society and, for that matter, the Democratic platform, which is filled with rhetoric around climate change, but doesn't have anything terribly substantive and certainly hasn't picked up much from AOC and Bernie and, as we said, Ilhan Omar, etc. So are we tilting at windmills? Is this another Don Quixote?
I hope not.
We can't afford that.
No.
We could use more windmills.
Real windmills. No, I mean, look, again, I'm not a climate scientist. And Noam is such a brilliant writer, and he uses such striking language. He says things in very powerful ways about the dire threat. And maybe if we took the room of 100 leading climate scientists, maybe 50 of them would say, well, no, maybe you need to tone it down a little bit. But the other 50 would say, you know, you need to ramp it up. So I think when Noam, for example, says, as he says in our book and other places, that Trump is a bigger threat to the human species than Hitler was, yes, of course, he's making a rhetorical point, but he's also saying Trump knowingly is allowing the climate to deteriorate to the point at which human life on Earth is under threat. Even Hitler didn't do that. That's what we're up against. And I was just looking at some polling evidence just a couple days ago, and I won't get the numbers exactly right, but this was from, you know, very reputable Pew polling research, and the numbers were quite favorable. It was somewhere around 70% of the people were saying, adult Americans were saying that climate change is real, and they want to take action around climate change, that we should invest in renewable energy, that we should not invest in fossil fuel energy. And about 80% were saying they themselves take action in their daily lives to protect the environment. Now, they may not be taking big actions, but I think that we are in a situation, if assuming that kind of polling evidence is accurate, that we have an overwhelming majority as long as, number one, we tell the story well, and then we fight, as you said, we've just got to mobilize people. People agree. I think if you get their attention, they agree. And so I think the opportunity now of coming out of this depression, we need answers. We can't just go back to the economy that we had before COVID. So this is an opportunity to do something transformative that can protect the environment, stabilize the climate, and build a more egalitarian society at the same time.
But maybe just a follow-up to that. The AFL-CIO, for example, organized labor, the House of Labor, where do they stand on this? And if they're not as demonstrative as they need to be, or even are fearful or deniers to some extent, do you talk to them? Obviously, you're doing a book with Noam Chomsky, which will be out, I understand, in the spring, and hopefully that will influence people.
Is there any indication
that organized labor is on board?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, if I may plug the book will be out in 20 days, not the spring. So, yeah.
Oh, fabulous.
Yeah, the book is on its way out. Secondly, I've done a lot of studies I've been commissioned by the labor leadership, organized mainstream labor leadership, in two states, Washington State and Colorado. And the work that I did, which is more or less as we've been talking about, was endorsed by the labor leadership in the state of Colorado. In fact, it was endorsed even by the building trade unions, who have never come out in favor of anything to do with a climate environmental program, but the fact that we built in a very, substantive program around just transition for the fossil fuel workers and communities that are going to be hurt by this, I think was the thing that enabled them to show support. So I think if those of us that are focused more around this issue recognize the real difficulties that some working people are going to face with this and deal with it openly and with a commitment, then I think we can get most of the labor movement behind us. I'm doing these studies right now in other states, Appalachia, and these are more of like activists and not the mainstream labor leadership, but we're talking to them, and eventually it's going to get through, because the facts are we can't keep burning fossil fuels if we want to make sure that the planet survives. We just can't.
Said you're working in Appalachia. Can you talk just a little bit, as we conclude, who you're working with?
Sure.
and what are the issues they're facing and which have caused them to organize for a Green New Deal in such a still terribly, terribly depressed area?
The groups that commissioned me, it's called Policy Matters Ohio. And I think the West Virginia, I forget exactly what it's called, Policy Center, and the Keystone Center in Pennsylvania. So basically I'm doing a similar kind of study as the ones I've done for the states like Colorado and the state of Maine. I did Maine, and I've done Washington State. I did New York State. That was 2017. Yeah, these people are in communication with the labor leadership. It was not the labor leadership that commissioned me, though, as it was in Colorado and Washington State. But they are in communication, and they're very focused on bringing labor on board in support of this. And a big part of it is giving a transitional program that is real for the workers and communities. It's also demonstrating to them that there will be opportunities. There will be big opportunities. And we have to get past this idea that, you know, the jobs are going to just be jobs for, right, like I was saying before, oh, you mean like engineers and scientists doing solar research? Well, sure, there'll be some of those, but not that many. And the real jobs are the ones that are, you know, working people are going to be able to get. They're going to be retrofitting buildings. They're going to be building cars. They're going to be delivering products in trucks and trains. They're going to be driving buses. That's really the essence of the job project.
Finally, what's the name of the book?
It's called Climate Crisis and the Global Green New Deal, The Political Economy of Saving the Planet.
Well, that's to the point.
Yeah.
That's to the point. Very excited, very excited. You've been so consistent. You've been on this for a long time. And hopefully that overshadows some of the terrible period, obviously, that you and your family have gone through. Getting the contagion. And, you know, take it slow. Take it slow. Take it slow. Stay strong. Stay well. Keep doing all the really critical work that you do, and I want to thank you so much for being with us. And we have been speaking with Robert Pollan, professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts, and that doesn't even say half of it.
All right, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Building Bridges, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Stay strong and stay well.